everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Dispatches from the Front. This is a Band of Brothers podcast. I am Tim, and joining me, as always, is my good friend, Captain Tom. How are you, Tom?
I'm good. Captain Sobel revoked my weekend pass, so even though it's Memorial Day, I'm here.
You're stuck here in the trenches. Yes, today is, in fact, Memorial Day. If you happen to listen to our last episode, which I certainly hope you did, and you heard that it was Memorial Day then, well, yes, it was. We're actually recording two episodes on the same day just because, well, Tom has this little thing that's going to be happening soon. His wife is having an Ewok very shortly, and we don't really know when, but like really soon.
No,
like any
we don't
moment.
Know when, and we haven't chosen the right Ewok name. So Chief Chirpa is on the table. Of course, Wicket is a top runner. It's, you know, we don't know the gender yet, so that'll have some influence. But yeah, we'll see. We'll have a little fuzzy one.
I got to wonder sometimes how, with all the Star Wars references that we throw into this show, like how often people who aren't Star Wars fans are like, what in the hell are these guys talking about?
But, you know, I look at it as you can have, this is a great example where you can be really obsessed with one thing, and that thing could be Band of Brothers, but you can have an affinity and a love for something else, and they don't have to conflict. They can just coexist in your brain. And you can live a very happy life like that. That's how
I look at this. Very true. Well, this, folks, is episode number 6, and we are talking about Bastogne. This is such a great episode because it encapsulates, quite honestly, not a long period of time. The Easy Company made its way toward Bastogne on or about December 19th. And they were, we'll say, quote, rescued by the Third Army, like Christmas Day or right about thereafter. So they weren't there for very long, although, quite honestly, what they were enduring probably made it feel like an eternity. And this episode really depicts in kind of a snapshot their own special bit of hell that our guys in Easy Company were dealing with while they were there in Bastogne. This episode, of course, originally written by Stephen Ambrose. The screenplay was done by Bruce McKenna. Did a little bit of looking into Bruce McKenna. This is his second of three Band of Brothers writing credits. He previously did Replacements, which we talked about a couple episodes ago. And then he has another episode, which he did later on. He also has some other writing credits kind of similar ilk. He did a number of episodes for The Pacific, and he did several episodes of a series called Six, which revolved around SEAL Team Six. This episode was directed by David Leland. Looking up his filmography was kind of interesting. He's a pretty seasoned British actor with credits going back to like the mid to late 60s. Does not have much of a directing career to speak of. I mean, there's a few things here and there, but nothing really notable, which is amazing because the direction of this episode was absolutely incredible. I mean, in terms of the depiction of the soldiers' experience in this environment, and this episode was one of the highest budgeted episodes that they did, building trees, bringing in trees that were actually, you know, removed from a forest, brought in and kind of temporarily placed. They built prop trees. They had all sorts of things in here to create this environment, and absolutely incredible. So we're going to talk a lot about this episode. It's very different from the previous episode that we talked about, Crossroads, which was almost a little more cerebral. There wasn't that much action to it. I mean, it did center around a particularly one major action that that Captain Winters ran, but most of it was kind of reflective. This one is very much truly in the trenches, in the foxholes with these guys and them enduring the environment just as much as they were enduring the German forces that they were defending against. So really interesting episode. Tom, can you kind of give us some of the details here of the plot?
Yeah, I wanted to just give one note on David Leland. I also looked at him, and I love that he has a music video credit to his name. He directed a Tom Petty music video for I Won't Back Down. So very famous song. I don't know if you even remember that music video, but I think that's awesome that if you're going to direct just a few things and two of those things are a Tom Petty video and a Band of Brothers episode that's really phenomenal, then that's not a bad life.
That's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I'd be good with that.
So for the Bastogne episode, it's set around Christmas in 1944. We've segued from Crossroads, where you get this sort of ominous shot of Easy coming in. They know they're about to be surrounded as the German army is coming in and cutting off the roads leading into this town. The 101st Airborne is operating out of Bastogne, absolutely besieged by German forces in a really harsh winter. Cold weather, clothing, rations, ammunition, medical supplies, everything that you need to fight a war was all very, very limited for the Easy Company soldiers. As they rode in the last episode, there was just a great bits of that is that the soldiers are freezing and shivering and just snatching and grabbing, borrowing and stealing whatever they can. Snow and fog are preventing the normal supply drops that would ordinarily resupply a unit in Easy's position. And Easy endures shelling and other probing attacks by the Germans throughout the day and night. The episode itself focuses on Easy Company's medic, Eugene Rowe, who spends the episode scrounging for supplies and triaging what wounds that he can. Rowe finds kinship with Renee, a Belgian nurse at Battalion Aid in the basement of a church. And meanwhile, Lieutenant Dyke, our intrepid hero of this episode, remains largely absent and finds excuses not to do his job.
Yeah. Lieutenant Dyke was a kind of like a side story of this whole episode. And in the next episode, we're going to see more of Lieutenant Dyke as well. But this one just really emphasizes the fact that whenever the guys need him, when they're looking for that a company officer leadership, they're looking for a decision to be made, he can never be, he's either never found or he's just in his foxhole. He's never upfront with the guys. He's never checking in on them. He constantly has an excuse for it. There's one offensive that the guys deal with here from the Germans. And he has a comment to Rowe as Rowe is headed forward into this engagement. Lieutenant Dyke is headed out of it, saying, "Yeah, there's been an attack. I'm gonna go let command know." Really, dude? He just ditches his guys, and obviously that loses a huge amount of respect. We talked about a few episodes ago the leadership characteristics that Dick Winters brings, and Lieutenant Dyke is like the complete opposite. There's zero leadership there. This is a guy who not only doesn't want to be there, I mean, no one really wants to be there, but he doesn't want to do his job and he doesn't have any concern for his men.
I think the line that encapsulates him, that scene encapsulates him very well, but the single line that encapsulates Dyke as a leader and an officer is as Rowe is getting his extra supply. So he forks over a little bit of extra morphine that he's got in his aid pouch. And he asks Rowe as he hands it over, "Well, what happens if I get hit?" And Rowe's like, "Well, I'll be there, sir." And that's, and then Dyke responds, "Well, I don't plan on getting hit." And it's such a perfect juxtaposition two very different approaches to soldiering that it just so perfectly encapsulates Dyke.
Yeah.
Like, unless his foxhole takes a direct hit from an artillery round, he's not going to be in any position to actually be in the line of fire.
Which is so true. It's absolutely true. So in terms of our cast here, we see our pretty much all of our normal guys. We do see some emphasis on Eugene Rowe quite a bit in this episode, as you mentioned. Really, a lot of it revolves around him and kind of what we would expect to be the normal trials and tribulations of a company medic as they're trying to take care of their guys. Most of it revolves around medical needs. Some of it revolves around kind of the indirect medical needs. Who is it? Joe Toy, who lost his boot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, while Roe is out and about, he's constantly looking for a pair of size 9 boots, which is, you know, what everyone's looking for, as Toy mentions when he's asked, "Hey, what's your size?" "It's size 9, just like every other guy." So we also obviously have Lieutenant Dyke that we talked about. We have Renee, who seems to basically be the head nurse, or the nurse that's certainly most engaged in the action at Battalion Aid, which is really properly in Bastogne. Most of this particular episode takes place in the Ardennes, which is the forest right outside surrounding Bastogne. We do get a couple of appearances by Colonel Sink. We have an appearance from General McAuliffe, who is the CEO of what, the 101st, Tom?
Yes. Yeah, he's the commander of the division.
Okay. And we also have one particular star, which you might have noticed, although his screen time is fairly brief. Some guy by the name of Michael Fassbender. He played a soldier by the name of Pat Christensen. And this again was a pretty young Michael Fassbender.
Yeah. I had to rewind and watch again. My wife caught it before I did. And I was looking for him in this episode, and it still almost snuck right past me.
Yeah. So go ahead.
I was just going to shift gears and sort of set the tone. Mm-hmm. Unlike last episode, when we were not really dealing with a major operation, we're right back into probably one of the most famous battles, if you will, of all of the war. So not to dive into a history lesson, but kind of wanted to orient everybody listening to exactly sort of what the 101st was involved in here in the Battle of the Bulge. What we had here was the actual battle itself stretched from mid-December to late January, 44 to 45. And this is the last major German offensive. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, the war V-Day or VE Day, Victory Europe Day, is in April of 45. So we're about, just a few months from total victory here. Of course, the Allied forces don't know that, but this is late in the war. You saw a little bit of the effects of that in the Crossroads episode, because there's a reason young soldiers like the one Dick Winter shot are in uniform and on the front lines for the Germans, because they're running out of career soldiers and normal military age males, and they're down to sort of the dregs of the barrel, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But Germany makes this last push. And this is on the Western Front, and primarily in Belgium, northeastern France, and Luxembourg. And so you're talking that same general quarter where Market Garden was. But is this a surprise attack? You don't get a whole lot of these, but the German army takes advantage here. They've been beaten back, and Allies have a huge advantage in the air, but the weather around this time has really grounded the Allied air forces. And you see that in part because it's not German fighter craft or any aircraft that are preventing these resupply drops. It's the terrible weather. I mean, they are socked in by a ton of fog. The Germans use this as a way to cover their advance, and they hit a weakly defended point in the line, and it just caught the Americans totally off guard. And a lot of the what fed into this was a little bit of overconfidence, lack of sort of reconnaissance, operational awareness, and the actual term Battle of the Bulge, if you looked on a map, the term came from the bulge in the German forces that appeared on a lot of the maps that depicted the movements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that provides a lot of good context, I think, for this. And largely this whole area is a lot of Belgium that got pushed through by the Germans here, and this is where the 101st was basically stuck for a while in this. Like we talked about before, the guys in the 101st, because of being so ill-equipped for this, they were dealing with both the environment and the Germans in this. And the Germans really had the 101st pretty much by the nads in this one. I mean, they had them fully surrounded. They had their supply lines cut off. For as much as the weather was also impacting the Germans to an extent, the Germans still had at least land-based supply lines in place. They mentioned in this episode some of the supply-dropped attempts that the Allies had for the 101st. Because of the snow, the fog, the winds, the Germans ended up recovering some of those supply drops. So they were getting resupplied not only of their own accord, but by the Allies. And, they were able to kind of sit in, and they were reasonably equipped for the cold weather. They had the armor that they needed. They had the ammunition that they needed. And even though they did not have a lot of experienced soldiers, they still had some experienced officers who were really able to lead this this whole offensive very well.
Camouflage, importantly. You see the German soldiers with white uniforms while the Americans are sitting there in OD greens.
Yep, exactly, which stands out pretty strongly against white, against all that white snow. And but that snow and fog certainly did, make that line between the two armies very fuzzy. And you had some German soldiers that kind of wandered across that line. You had some of the 101st guys who wandered across that line. In fact, the opening shot of this episode, I believe, was Winter shaving, which... Damn, shaving in the cold in the open like that, presumably with cold water. And like even my wife asked, and we were watching it, she's like, why in the world is he shaving? I said, well, he's a battalion officer. I see. Yes, there is an expectation that the guys would shave, but the guys at the front line, if they miss a couple days shaving, they're probably not going to get ragged for it. But a battalion officer is going to be expected to be regulation, right? I mean, that's
and guess who shows up right as he's in the middle of the shave, kind of right after the attack happens? Colonel Sink and the division commander. He's Winter still has the shaving cream on his face as they're briefing.
And, which at this point is probably just frozen onto his face.
I know, God. And then who but poor, Captain Nixon comes like crawling out of his foxhole looking ragged.
And Colonel Sink's like, sorry for waking you up there, Lieutenant Nixon.
You want to update the general on what's going on?
And Nixon at least had an excuse. Well, I did a reconnoiter at about 3 a.m., sir.
Yeah,
and
he slipped that one in there real nicely.
Yeah. But even before that happened, Winters and Roe was with him. This is when we first see Roe. He's going around foxhole to foxhole asking for bandages and surrettes. And as they're there talking, Winters looks past Roe and sees a German soldier who's getting ready to take a dump. Yeah. He wandered a little bit across the line and you know, there he is in the woods, pulling his pants down, and you know, Winters grabs a rifle and holds it on him, and you know, gets the guy to come over, and the guy's got to, you know, hold it in before he lets it go, and hike his pants up, and now he's a POW, and he's going to get questioned. So yeah, there's like a lot of literally fog of war stuff happening that neither side really has full intel on what's going on. You've got soldiers wandering across that line because no one really knows where it is. If a little bit later on in this episode, Roe is, I can't remember who he's with, but he's kind of going through the woods with someone else, and they actually fall into a German foxhole, which was covered up with a blanket, so it had some snow on it. They didn't know it was there. They fall in. Fortunately, they got away without getting shot, although they did get shot at. So there's just, you know, a lot of crazy stuff happening with this. The Germans, another advantage that they had, certainly they had artillery support, which the Allies did not have, particularly the 101st didn't have, because they were inside. They were surrounded by the Germans here. And one thing that the Germans did was trying to use the environment against the Allies, which was a brutal tactic, but very smart, setting some of their shells for air bursts. So we're talking 20, 30 feet above the ground, setting those shells to burst so they would basically turn the trees real tall. You know, you watch the episode, you see these real tall pine trees turning the trees into shrapnel, which would then rain down on top of the soldiers. So in the episode, you see guys having to have chunks of wood pulled out of their bodies. Some were crushed by the tops of trees, along with being impacted directly by the artillery itself. So pretty crazy. And then along with this, these periodic attacks, daytime, nighttime, just to constantly push at these guys in the 101st, unnerve them, minimize their sleep, weaken them, get them to use some of their limited resources. And it was just kind of this constant thing that was going on throughout this engagement.
You made a really good point on the air burst and the use of the environment against them. You actually see a pretty prominent character take the brunt of that, Lieutenant Harry Welsh, that you guys might recognize him. He's got the little gap between his front teeth. Mm-hmm. He gets pretty badly injured, and it's mostly like when they cut away his trousers, it's mostly wood that's stuck in him. It's not, you know, shrapnel from the actual blast, but it's this environmental shrapnel.
Yeah.
And it really gave a sense of terror that you hadn't seen since World War One. And you rarely had a fixed defensive position like that was under a bombardment for the Allies. I mean, you know, we were just not in position to, you know, face that sort of thing down. And you make a great point that not only are they, you know, tactically using brutal tactics, but from a psychological standpoint, I mean, the Allies have no idea when this artillery is coming. It's obviously sighted into the American lines, and it's like a lottery system, basically. You have no idea where that round is going to land, and it's just a matter of time whether it hits your foxhole or not. And, yep. You know, I love the business with Toy, because he loses his boots, like you mentioned. And when Roe was asking him how that happened, he said he set him out to dry, and at just an unlucky round blew him up, you know, leaving him shoeless in the you know, snow covered forest.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a lot of stuff that they were facing here. So again, the big focus on this episode was company medic Eugene Roe. And it really did give a good snapshot, I think, of what these guys were dealing with medically. We talked about the limited amount of supplies that they had. So limited bandages, limited plasma, limited morphine, limited antibiotics that they had access to. And essentially, based on the injuries that the guys had, the triage that they received would kind of continue moving them back further and further. So it might be something that the medic could treat in the front line and the guy would be fine and still fit to fight. Might get moved back to a field aid station, which they did not have. And that was mentioned repeatedly in this. They simply didn't have the resources to have that intermediary level of care to be able to pull someone back and do this. So either they were treated in the field just by the medic. They had no doctors in place to deploy into the field. Or they went back to the battalion aid hospital, which, as you mentioned, Tom, was basically in a church back in the village of Bastogne. And that was staffed not only by a few U.S. Army folks, not too many, mostly by locals. So it seemed there might have been a couple of local docs, a couple of local nurses, some folks with some medical training, and then probably a handful of volunteers who didn't have any medical training but were moving litters and washing supplies and that kind of stuff. Because they had no supply line, they weren't able not only to get supplies in, but they also couldn't move anyone out. So those were who were severely wounded, who would have otherwise gone to more definitive care, like a real hospital, and certainly those who were deceased, who really, for a number of reasons, you don't want the bodies lying around. It's a morale issue. It becomes a disease issue. It becomes a physical space issue. You don't want those bodies around. So you would also move those out. And unfortunately, they were stacking dead bodies like cordwood just outside of this this church. And it was seriously limited and pretty demoralizing. I mean, when Roe went back there to go get some supplies, you could really just kind of see the shock in his face because it was something that he wasn't used to. He was used to that established system that they had of, okay, I'm the guy at the front line, and then if someone's severely injured enough, I move them back a step. And if they're injured enough, they then go back a step from there. And then if they're injured enough, we get them the hell out of the area. And so this is something he wasn't used to. Scrounging for all the supplies that he possibly could. A lot of stuff for the guys who were so severely wounded, essentially mortally wounded, came down to comfort care. You know, you shoot them up with two or three sarets of morphine and you know they're going to die. They're either going to bleed out or otherwise succumb to their injuries, and you want them to be as comfortable as possible. And, you know, that was kind of a moral dilemma that they were dealing with was, geez, we have this really limited supply of morphine, and are we going to shoot these guys up who are mortally wounded and let them die peacefully, or hold on to the morphine for the guys who we know we can save? And the same thing with a lot of the other supplies.
The triaging is a big part of it, because you see, I think it's Guarnier. Guarnier has, I don't know if it's an STD or what, but he keeps complaining about his piss just burning.
It burns when it pees.
Doc, I'm pissing needles over here, and he can't do anything for him. He's got no antibiotics. And there's a quick line in there, but a significant one. The Germans, in the lead up to this battle, captured an American medical unit. So the 326th Medical Company, Medical Battalion, I can't remember what echelon it was, but all the doctors, all the supplies of that unit, all those critical things got snatched up. And that set the stage for the trouble that Roe has in this episode. And I just, you bring up a really good point when you talk about him scrounging for supplies, because imagine how difficult a combat medic's job is to begin with. It's a tough thing to treat battlefield injuries, especially severe ones. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, he's running from foxhole to foxhole out in the open just to be able to get the supplies he needs to do his job. Yeah. So he's on this constant mission, and he's like tireless in it. I mean, it's pretty fascinating. He just does not quit. The whole episode, he's just constantly scrounging for stuff.
Yeah,
and he's got to do that out of necessity. I mean, yeah, I think they bring up some of the supply issues to General McCulloch, and his response is just get it done. You know, Colonel Sink said about the same thing, which was beg, borrow, and steal what you can and hold the line.
Mm-hmm.
There's just not much other answer for it. And so that becomes a real challenge for him, to the point there's a really poignant scene. You bring up the battalion, like the field hospital back in that church, and he's asking for supplies from Renee, and she gives him a box, and he kind of pulls out this bandage, and he's like, "What is this?" And she's like, "Bed sheets." And they're at the point where they're ripping stuff up and using that to seal up wounds. And then, at the end of the episode, there's a really poignant moment where he ends up using Renee's scarf mm-hmm. to do the same thing to as a bandage for another soldier.
Yeah. Yeah. They just continue to drive home the fact that they're so limited in supplies. And, not only that, it's like he's kind of spending his quote downtime doing all this scrounging and checking in with the other companies and going back to the battalion aid hospital and going from foxhole to foxhole. He even takes a bandage off of the German soldier that was captured. Mm-hmm. And so he has that, and just, yeah, it's just incredible. And then that seems to be broken up with the one thing that I think, at least for me, like goes into your soul. And that's every time there would be an engagement and you just hear someone scream out, "Medic!"
Yeah.
And like, that's just like one of the most disturbing things. And obviously these medics are freaking heroes. I mean, drop whatever they're doing, run immediately into an engaged combat area with very little regard for their own personal safety to stop some bleeding and pull these people the hell out of there and get them to more definitive care. And it's just amazing what they do. But that constant scream of "medic" just like shakes you to your soul. And especially in this episode where it's following, you're following Ro around so much, you come to sympathize with him tremendously through this.
And what did you not see Ro carrying throughout the episode? He doesn't have a weapon.
No weapon.
He's got no rifle, no sidearm. Medics are certainly allowed to carry a weapon and use it for defensive purposes, but he's got nothing. And he's not only running around out in the open with no cover. He's not just sitting in his foxhole, Lieutenant Dyke style, but he's got no protection for himself other than the tin bucket on his head. And you sort of see this, they're leading a patrol out and he wants to go on it. And you see one of the sergeants there tells him, this is Sergeant Martin, in fact, tells him this is a combat patrol. Why don't you stick back where it's safe?
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of frustratingly squats against the tree as they move off. And sure enough, a soldier gets hit pretty badly. And another soldier is there. He can't ultimately help or save that soldier. But another soldier gets hit in the back as they're retreating. And, he runs right into action. I think what's fascinating to me about Ro's character is he explains a little bit about this, his background to Renee as he's opening up.
Mm-hmm.
He's this odd duck in Easy Company. He doesn't seem to really mesh with the other soldiers. They are kind of complaining to each other, like, "Why didn't he call me?" He calls one of the soldiers Edward, and he's like, "That's not my name." We all go by our nicknames. And Ro just has this sort of disconnect and doesn't pal around, doesn't joke.
Yeah.
But he's got this genuine care for his other brothers in arms that bleeds through in everything that he does. And he talks to Renee about how his mother was a Cajun healer. And so this is not somebody that just got assigned to be a medic and moved on. This is somebody that's fulfilling sort of a lifelong calling.
Yeah.
And you see him sort of develop as the episode goes on. But one of the things that best encapsulates it is when he sees Toy without boots and you know, Toy is just sort of given up hope. He's like, well, I'm a size 9, just like anybody else. And what you hear in Toy's voice is this resignation. Like, I will tell you what the answer you're asking me, but I don't expect you to be able to fix this problem for me. And what's the first thing that Ro does when he rolls into town, but he pulls a pair of boots and brings them? Yeah. A lot of people would have just forgotten.
Sure.
You know, and fair enough, not being dicks about it, but they just would have forgotten and gotten back and been like, oh, Toy, your feet. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Here's some bed sheets. Wrap them in that. But he takes care of him. And then by the end of the episode, you finally see him. I forget who it is, but he finally calls somebody by their nickname and they're like, hey, this Ro's not a bad guy.
Yeah.
I forgot about all the lives he saved, but now that he calls me by my nickname, you're all right in my book.
Yep. Yeah, you do see that interesting turnaround where he does kind of start to mesh with the guys a little bit more. And despite the lack of the interpersonal relationship, he's obviously still 100% dedicated to the mission. You know, he's taking care of the guys. He's doing what he has to do for them. He was on his search for scissors. His search for scissors, like the whole front half of the episode, he's looking for a pair of scissors.
And I love how he gets them too. Was it Picante? He ends up dumping his bag out, just takes them. My scissors.
It was quite a thing. You know, we do see some a handful of engagements occur within this episode, and Buck is someone who we've kind of seen. You mentioned in the last episode that we're kind of seeing a bit of PTSD in Buck's journey. He's becoming more reserved, more quiet, more reflective. He doesn't seem with it. He seems like in this fog, this lethargy, that he's just kind of going through the motions and just kind of existing. And we don't see a lot of him in this episode. I mean, the episode wasn't focused on him, but the couple of scenes that he was in, he's very intentionally just kind of there. And, you know, the guys even have a conversation with him at some point about him being in college, because he was talking about, oh, well, this is the environment that the Romans dealt with when they were fighting the Goths and the Visigoths, and they were here in the winter, and this is the, you know, in this forest and all that stuff. And he's kind of just going in a rote fashion through stuff in his memory from taking history classes in college, and the guys start questioning him about it. But he would just, he wasn't there. You could tell he was very disconnected.
Did he also get a Dear John letter in this? I thought there was a scene because he's sharing a picture of his girl, and it's like him with a baseball cap. And I'm pretty sure that she dumped him.
Yes.
And that they're talking about the enlisted soldiers are talking about how that is pretty crummy. She would do that over Christmas.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, you're right. I actually forgot about that. So, yeah, you know, that's one more thing that is obviously pretty depressing to anyone. And especially when you're halfway across the world and there's not much you can do about it. You can't even have a conversation with that person. So that's pretty depressing and demoralizing. And that's just another blow to Buck and everything that he's been dealing with. And like I said, in the next episode, we see things degrade even more for him as he just starts to deal with more death and destruction around him.
Yeah, and I guess I should correct myself. The proper term, as described by Bill Guarnier, was a Dear Bull letter.
Yeah.
I got that wrong. I find it funny that the character, you know, his nickname is gonorrhea, and he may or may not have an STD.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know, cool irony.
I couched it as a UTI, you know, some type of urinary tract infection, just because they really don't show much opportunity for these guys to be consorting, if you will, with any of the locals. But yeah, it may very well be some measure of an STD or something that he's got. Either way, it's a bacterial infection. It burns when he pisses. And he is constantly after Roe to help him out with this. And of course, you know, Roe's solution is, I don't have any more antibiotics. All I can tell you is drink more water. to which Guarnier says, well, it hurts when I piss. Why would I drink more water?
Well, that's what's so great, because the running joke is that if you get hurt in the, you know, you're a service member or whatever, you go to get treatment for it. The joke is that their number one remedy is a little bit of Motrin and some water. Like, you know, take some Advil and drink some water. You'll be fine.
Yep.
Like, and has your arm fallen off? No. Well, here's some Advil and some water. And that was that interaction right there. Like, well, drink a little water. It's the heal all.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. what else do we want to cover here? Was there any, how about some military lingo that came at us?
Oh yeah. So I thought about this, and since most of the episode is focused on Roe and his duties as a medic, two out of the three here will be in line with that theme. The first one was plasma, and this isn't so much a military term. If you're familiar with medical terms and whatnot, plasma is probably pretty familiar. But this is a pretty essential battlefield tool, and it still gets used today.
Mm-hmm.
The primary purpose of it is to help blood clot. So it's essential to, Tim, you talked about quite a bit the business and strategy of speeding soldiers to the rear for care. So this, I think the common term would be a medevac.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get a soldier to the proper level of medical care as quickly as possible. And plasma is a really critical tool to help stabilize somebody and extend out their life. And especially in situations where you're just trying to stop the bleeding. And that's why it's such a critical tool. And not only is Roe looking for morphine, which is critical to pain management, but that plasma is really, really critical as well. And so when he finally gets some, it's sort of a really keystone moment in the episode. And interestingly, just last year, units in the U.S. military started to field on a more widespread level freeze-dried plasma.
Mm-hmm.
And this is stuff where medics, you can carry it in your actual aid pouch, and then medics can carry it as well, and often do. But you can mix it with some water, and it becomes actual plasma. So it's a lighter, rather than carry a big jar or vial of plasma around, you can carry it in a much more compact fashion, and it allows the average soldier to keep some in their first aid kit, which is really important. The next would be trench foot. And this is, you see this in the context of Joe Toy. That's Roe's sort of quick diagnosis of him when he takes a look at his feet, because he gets in the boots and he still is having problems with his feet. And he's talking to another lieutenant or another soldier. I can't remember if it was a lieutenant, but he's got problems with his feet. He's feeling like pins and needles, and mm-hmm. he tells him to walk around and whatnot. Trench foot is something that we've all probably heard of. It's a condition that really got its name in World War I when you talk about trench warfare. But it's a pretty terrible condition that comes from constant or prolonged exposure to really damp, cold conditions. And I can only imagine what Joe Toy was going through. You get your feet in the snow, you've got some socks to sort of protect them, but your feet are just constantly cold and a little wet. And it just causes all sorts of, tremendous pain. You can, at later stages, blisters and sores can open up, which can get infected. And then ultimately, this can lead to gangrene, which is what Roe reminds him of, or warns him of. And your feet can really start to stink as tissue starts to die and decay. And that's where you can end up needing amputation to really prevent the spread of it. So it's a pretty terrible condition, but one, and it's not just limited to cold weather. I don't know if they touch on it in the Pacific or not, but you pop in any Vietnam movie. I mean, what's the first thing that Forrest Gump and Bubba get reminded of when they land in Vietnam?
Clean socks.
Like, take care of your feet. Yeah. Yep. Take care of feet. Keep them dry.
Clean socks.
That's to
dry
avoid
boots.
That trench foot.
You know, I mean, how, you know, plastic bags, if, not so much in World War II, but after that, you know, putting your feet in plastic bags, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Lieutenant Dan's got two rules. Don't do anything stupid and take care of your feet.
That's right.
So those are Rose rules as well. And the last one would be suppressive fire. And I can't remember if I covered this before, but it's one thing. Sergeant Martin, as they're out on patrol, one of their young privates gets hit, shot through the neck, and he's down. And he's exposed to enemy fire, and he keeps writhing around in pain, which causes the Germans to continue firing. And nobody from the patrol can get to him because German bullets are flying downrange. Mm-hmm. And so Sergeant Martin gives the order. He brings everybody up online, which means, you know, all elements of this patrol are literally in a line so they can have separate fields of fire. And then he yells suppressive fire. And suppressive fire is not meant to be accurately placed rounds, but ideally it's a high volume of fire from a unit that is meant to degrade the effectiveness of the enemy. So the enemy's firing at you, you put suppressive, exactly, yeah. You make them duck. And the idea is, in the enemy's mind, if they pop their head up, they're going to be exposed to death or pretty serious injury. So you're not necessarily knocking an enemy after enemy down, but you're enabling either your unit to move or somebody in this case to go tend to the wounded. Unfortunately, their suppressive fire really doesn't work here, and they have to fall back.
Yep.
But that is your military lingo for this episode.
Awesome. Fantastic. So this episode wraps up, some of the episodes will kind of wrap up with a, just like a couple sentence, text that they'll throw on the screen there. And at the end of this, they mentioned that, eventually the 101st was, retrieved by Patton's Third Army, who came in. And, if you watch the movie Patton, if you're familiar with that, they talk quite a bit about how quickly Patton was able to mobilize the Third Army, basically redirecting them from a mission that they were already on and mobilizing them as quickly as they possibly could, north toward Bastogne, busting through the German lines and getting into Bastogne. And they do have the mention there that no one from the 501st to this day will acknowledge the fact that they even needed rescuing. You know, certainly a matter of pride for them. I mean, you know, kudos to them. They held out for quite a long time. You know, obviously, I think the reality of it is that eventually they would not have continued to sustain that German attack and the pressure that they had there. But, you know, it definitely does not diminish what they were able to accomplish while they were there. Anything you want to add to that, Tom?
Just the last point I would make is watching those interviews at the beginning, it's clear that of all the significant moments that the men of this unit had during World War II, Bastogne really left a lasting impression on them. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I never forgot this quote, and it was just as poignant when I watched it again, but the one soldier says, you know, even on cold nights, even today, you know, I'll be tucked in bed with my wife and I'll lean over to her and say, I'm just glad I'm not in Bastogne.
Yeah.
And you think about that, that's some pretty lasting impact, you know, on the mind of some pretty tough guys. So it really sends home the significance of this, not just the episode, but really what the guys went through.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure does. Just a kind of another epilogue here that I want to throw in just because it has somewhat of an attachment to me, and some of my background. As I've mentioned before, a lot of my career has been in public safety, particularly doing disaster management work. And so there's an interesting tie with General McAuliffe, who after the war, when he came back to the States, he was, you know, after World War II, we were very much, we were getting into the Cold War here. And so civil defense was the big movement domestically. And civil defense is eventually became emergency management as we know it now, once it got out of this kind of Cold War mindset to dealing with natural hazards and other stuff. But General McAuliffe, when he came stateside after the war, he became New York State's first director of civil defense, which was the civil defense agency for the state became the state's emergency management agency, which is where I worked for 10 years of my career. So just kind of this little historical tie to McAuliffe. And actually, we didn't have it on our show notes. I can't believe we both forgot about it. There's a very famous quote from General McAuliffe.
Yeah.
Kind of in the middle of this siege, when the German commander who's trying to end this siege sends a message to McAuliffe saying, hey, look, you know, spare the lives and the time and, you know, surrender peacefully and we'll spare your lives. And McAuliffe's response to the German commander was one word, nuts, which in 1940s lingo is essentially piss off. that's really what it comes down to. So, you know, I think in the movie Patton, when he hears that, remarks that such an eloquent man needs to be saved. So yeah, just kind of a great little thing about McAuliffe, and we very briefly mentioned his very matter of fact speech that he gave to Easy early on in the episode when we see him, where he pretty much just says, "Continue doing what you're doing, survive, and keep the enemy at bay." I mean, he didn't have anything inspirational to tell them, not that help is on the way, not that we're going to do fine, not that the weather's going to break, none of that. It was just, this sucks and you guys need to keep going. There was nothing else, you know?
Yeah. But you saw how impactful that response was, because it got read out to the men and they were all just cracking up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really boosted morale, maybe where his inspirational, non-inspirational speech didn't before.
Yeah. I totally agree. So with that, Tom, unless you have any final thoughts on this episode, we'll wrap things up. Folks, join us for the next episode, which is The Breaking Point. If you have any comments or feedback, we definitely appreciate them. One way you can send them to us is by way of email, which you can reach us at dispatches@randomchatter.com.
We both encourage you to reach out, find us online. I can speak safely for both of us that we love hearing from folks that are listening to this. I don't care if you want to talk Band of Brothers, you can reach out to us to talk literally anything. And
not Star Wars, though. We know nothing about Star Wars.
No, I'm not a big fan. You know, if you want to talk Star Trek, I may be more receptive to that. But no, but I genuinely enjoy talking to folks, and if you get some enjoyment out of this show and want to talk about that, that's all the better. I'm always game to nerd out about just about anything. But you can find us on Twitter at Random Chatter is the network's tag. Tim, where can they find you on Twitter?
At Qui-Gon Tim. That's Tim with two M's.
You can find me on Twitter at Thomas L. L as in Larry Harper, H-A-R-P-E-R. You can find all of our shows at randomchatter.com, expertly organized and easily navigable.
We also appreciate if you spread the word and support us. Please tell your friends, family, coworkers, total strangers, anyone who you know is interested in World War II history, anyone who's a fan of Band of Brothers, please have them join us. We're only really just a few episodes in. Start into episode one and kind of watch along with us and enjoy. We also appreciate it if you leave us some great reviews, iTunes, Google Play, wherever it is where you might be getting your podcast from. Those reviews help other people to find us and convince them that they should listen to us. And you know, while Tom and I would probably do this anyway, even if we had no listeners, just because we enjoy talking about this stuff, it definitely helps knowing that we have at least more than like Tom's mom listening to this episode. So
she's just listening to get baby updates at this point.
Okay. Yeah. So click on all the stars, write in a sentence or two about why you like the show. We definitely appreciate that. We also appreciate some financial support, which helps out the entire network. We keep on multiplying the number of shows that we have on this network. And just in the last few months, we have like grown exponentially with a variety of interests. We have Star Wars, we have general entertainment, we have superhero shows, we have all sorts of different things. So that helps us. Financial support helps us to cover the costs of managing an organization. It helps us to take care of our web hosting fees and our data storage fees and all that kind of stuff that we have. You can find out more over randomchatter.com/Patreon. That's PATREON. Just $1 a month, which is the minimum contribution, makes a huge difference. And for every contribution you give to us, we also give back to you. So that $1 a month gets you access to our online Discord community, where you can talk to hosts and other fans about this show, other shows, a variety of different topics. You get into the $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month. You get not only that Patreon or that Discord access, but you get access to other exclusive material, early releases, that kind of thing. We definitely give back to you. If you want to get into, say, I don't know, what's it going to take, Tom? $10,000 a month? We will let you name Tom's child.
Yeah, I think, you know, that kind of level, you can pick your Ewok name and that'll be what's on the birth certificate.
Yeah. And Tom's wife is totally cool with this, right?
100%. She's nodding her head right now enthusiastically. Yeah. I definitely won't die as a result of this pledge.
It was nice knowing you, Tom. also, if you want to find out more about Discord, without the Patreon commitment, you can go to randomchatter.com/Discord. You can get some free but limited access to our Discord community. We do have some public areas that you can get into, sample it, try it out, see if you like it, and hopefully you will and make at least that $1 a month contribution. Thank you very much.
Tim, you challenged me and gave me an idea in the last episode to do my favorite portion, this disclaimer in character as Sobel. And I didn't just want to launch into it because I'm not guaranteed to do a very good impression, but with this caveat, I will say that all passes are revoked. You people should know that Dispatches from the Front is not endorsed by Home Box Office Incorporated and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Entertainment that none of you will have because your passes have been revoked. All names and references with and references to the Band of Brothers series, including private bullshit over here, are registered trademarks and or copyrights of HBO or their respective trademark and copyright holders, none of which none of you have the rank to even come close to. Random Chatter Media and Dispatches from the Front are not affiliated with HBO. They're mere maggots in the sand. All original content of Dispatches from the Front is the intellectual property of Random Chatter Media, unless otherwise indicated. You are dismissed.
Fantastic. The only thing you were missing was the fur collared jacket.
Yeah. Well, I'm wearing that. You guys just can't see that.
All right, folks. Well, thank you once again for joining us, and we will see you in a couple of weeks, hopefully, with The Breaking Point.
Adios. Adios.